Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David C. Corton, author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, who explains why he believes now is the time to undertake a thorough redesign of the dangerous architecture of the U.S. economic system. Kevin Bankston of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who examines the power President Obama has to undo the Bush administration's illegal, warrantless surveillance program. And Jack Cole, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, who describes the successful effort last year to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana in Massachusetts. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistan's nuclear program, who orchestrated a black market nuclear operation, was released in early February after 5 years under house arrest in Pakistan. Khan was arrested in 2004 after Western intelligence officials stopped a ship headed to Libya with machine parts used to enrich uranium, exposing the Pakistani scientists' illicit international nuclear network. According to United Nations inspectors, Khan gave blueprints for the manufacture of nuclear weapons to Iran, Libya, and North Korea, and was active in a dozen countries. In 2004, the government of President Pervez Musharraf made Khan confess in public for his misdeeds. Musharraf then pardoned him and put Khan under house arrest. American and Western intelligence officials were never able to question Khan about his nuclear network or pursue leads about support he likely received from Pakistani intelligence agencies. According to the Washington Post, considerable doubt remains about the notion that Khan's underground network was disbanded. Nuclear weapons blueprints have been recently discovered on computers in Switzerland and Dubai. Attempts to prosecute Khan's known contacts have failed. Swiss prosecutors have charged the Bush administration with withholding critical evidence needed to convict three Swiss nationals in Khan's network. One of those suspected has now told Swiss television that he was working undercover for the CIA. The Obama administration's policy on Africa will get an early test in the International Criminal Court, or ICC, as the court is expected to issue an arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir on charges of committing atrocities in Darfur in western Sudan. If the arrest warrant is issued, Bashir has promised to punish United Nations humanitarian operations in Sudan, inflict more pain on Darfur, and go after separatist groups in southern Sudan. There is growing pressure in Africa for the ICC to withdraw the threat of the arrest warrant. Susan Rice, the new U.S. ambassador to the UN, has articulated strong opposition to genocide in recent years and once called for U.S. airstrikes in Darfur. But now Rice has to negotiate directly with Sudan, which currently chairs the influential Group of 77 developing countries at the United Nations. For the next year, Khartoum will be a leading party in international negotiations over climate change, the UN budget, and the global financial crisis. In response, Rice says the Obama administration is going to be very strong and energetic in an effort to deal effectively with the ongoing genocide and make it very clear that the behavior of the government of Sudan is simply unacceptable and something we condemn. According to the ICC's chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, over 450,000 people have died from violence and disease in the Darfur conflict since 2003. And nearly 3 million people have been forced to flee from their homes. In New York State's North Country, wind power is not just a feel-good mantra, but a real source of good-paying jobs for the future. The area below the Canadian border is one of the windiest spots in the nation and already produces 690 megawatts of clean energy. Clinton Community College is now training wind power operation technicians who can make $50,000 a year. These new jobs will fill a vacuum in a region decimated by the loss of the manufacturing base and family farms. These positions combine old-fashioned blue-collar sensibilities with high-tech computer skills. But clean energy producers face strong headwinds due to the current economic crisis, according to The Nation magazine. Like many environmental firms, they have trouble getting access to credit and face cuts in state renewable energy programs. Activists are hoping green stimulus funds from the Obama administration will revive the clean energy industry. Funding for weatherization and energy efficiency programs can create thousands of new jobs, but Congress is more reluctant to fund longer-term projects like upgrading the electric power grid or high-speed rail. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After campaigning hard in his first 3 weeks in office for an economic stimulus package to address the nation's deepest economic crisis since the Great Depression, President Barack Obama's efforts paid off, but with two very different bills passing the House and Senate. The Senate approved an $838 billion stimulus bill, while only attracting the votes of three Senate Republicans. The House, which passed its own $819 billion stimulus package with no GOP votes, must now work with the Senate to negotiate a unified bill. Mr. Obama has urged the restoration of $108 billion in cuts made by the Senate in school construction funds and assistance for cash-strapped states. Both spending bills allocate money for job-creating infrastructure projects, mass transit, increased funding for unemployment benefits, health care, and food stamps to assist those hit hard by the economic downturn. Meanwhile, the newly confirmed Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner unveiled key elements of the Obama administration's bank bailout plan. The plan includes a review of shaky banks, with strings attached to new government aid, incentives to attract the purchase of $500 billion or more in toxic mortgage-backed securities, the spending of at least $50 billion to prevent future home foreclosures, and Federal Reserve stimulation of private sector lending. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David C. Corton, founder and president of the People-Centered Development Forum and author of the critically acclaimed books The Great Turning and When Corporations Rule the World. His new book is titled Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. Here, Corton explains why he believes the current U.S. financial crisis has exposed the critical need to redesign the dysfunctional and dangerous architecture of the U.S. economic system.
Obama's got a great dilemma. He was handed a huge mess. But what we're not getting is any real discussion of how did we get into this? Why are we in it? You know, is restoring the system to its previous function really an answer, given the larger picture that clearly is a failed financial system that was running out of control, and getting it back running out of control isn't going to help us. And then the larger frame, which gets almost no attention in connection with the stimulus and bailout packages, that our existing economic system has been also failing environmentally and socially. It's been pushing the most wasteful forms of consumption, and it is also absolutely designed to increase inequality in a nation and in a world that is increasingly suffering social fragmentation and breakdown because of the extreme gap in wealth between the very rich and the very poor. You know, we really need to expand the discussion and to begin focusing solutions on really deeper transformational changes in the economic system and the whole underlying idea of what the purpose of our economy is and how we can restructure it, starting, of course, with the system of finance, which is the driving system.
And, David, the essential message I took from your book is that this financial crisis has exposed the critical need to redesign our dysfunctional and dangerous architecture of the U.S. Economic system and its institutions. And I wonder if you would sort of just address the whole notion that we are kind of in a once-in-a-generation moment in history where the underpinnings of the system are exposed like they are in tatters, and it is a chance to rethink it and rebuild it.
Absolutely. Timing is everything in addressing these issues. And we are at a moment of readiness because there is just universal outrage at Wall Street, which is the heart of the problem. People are very eager to get some basis of understanding why things are going wrong and some sense of hope that they can be fixed. But we need to look way beyond the current solutions. You know, I build much of my analysis on the distinction between Wall Street, which is kind of a metaphor for the financial institutions that exist simply for their own profit and the benefit of their managers, versus Main Street, which tends to be comprised of smaller businesses that are locally owned by people that live in a community and have an interest in the health and well-being of the community and its environment. So they're not simply in it for the money. Of course, one of the things that the government officials should be aware of as they try to restore these banks is that, you know, the banks are, you know, they've still got their same managers who are, for the most part, whose only real agenda is to maximize their own salaries, their own paychecks. We don't the system no longer is even devoted to maximizing returns to shareholders. It's narrowed its focus even more. As you step back, Wall Street is the power that it has is in its control over the issuance and the allocation of money in a society in which most everything we do depends on money. So, you know, we're held hostage to its greed and interests, and it's time to move beyond that to recognize that that Wall Street is a pathological criminal syndicate devoted to essentially stealing from the rest of society.
How do we spark a popular discussion and debate on the future of our economic system? As we were talking about before, it seems to be just a once-in-a-generation opportunity to have this debate. In your view, what do we have to do as citizens to move this debate along?
Well, there are kind of two fronts. One is banding together to rebuild local economies and local communities. And, you know, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which I serve on the board of, is an organization that is very much at the forefront of that. The other is just simply expanding the conversation, getting these the deeper issues and the alternatives out there into the public discourse. So part of that is through independent media, doing exactly what you're doing with your program, and many other independent news and talk shows are doing through our valuable independent media. And of course, another is the reason I wrote this book, Agenda for a New Economy, is to provide a vehicle for around which people can engage that conversation.
That was David C. Corton, author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. Read his articles and commentary online at his website, davidcorton.org. Just one day after President Bush left the White House, former National Security Agency analyst Russell Tice came forward to disclose that he had seen firsthand evidence that the Bush administration's warrantless surveillance program had monitored the domestic communications of all Americans and, most disturbingly, targeted U.S. journalists. Tice, who made these charges on Keith Olbermann's MSNBC Countdown program, has confirmed he was one of the anonymous sources for the New York Times 2005 story on the government's warrantless wiretapping program. Tice's disclosure corroborates some of what former AT&T employee Mark Klein revealed, describing the phone giant's facilities in San Francisco, where domestic and international phone and email traffic were routed to a secret room allegedly used by the National Security Agency. During the presidential campaign, many of Barack Obama's supporters were disappointed when then-Senator Obama cast a reluctant vote in favor of a Senate bill that granted retroactive immunity to telecommunication companies, which had cooperated with the Bush administration's warrantless surveillance operations. Now, in the Oval Office, Mr. Obama has the power to undo the retroactive immunity law. But thus far, the president and his recently confirmed Attorney General Eric Holder have given mixed signals on their intentions. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who examines the legal levers the Obama administration has to undo the Bush administration's illegal wiretap program.
Well, Mr. Tice on the Keith Olbermann show Countdown, shortly after the inauguration, perhaps thinking that he may be now a bit freer to speak than under the previous administration, came forward to reveal more details about the NSA's, the National Security Agency's, warrantless spying. Mr. Tice is a former NSA analyst, and he has spoken about the NSA program before, but not in as much detail as he did last month. And what he revealed, first off, was that President Bush's claim that the so-called terrorist surveillance program, his claims that it was narrowly targeted at the international communications of people linked to terrorism, was not true, and that the NSA had actually specifically targeted and monitored the communications of American journalist organizations. Mr. Tice went on further, though, to confirm what we have been alleging based on widespread news reports and other whistleblower reports for 3 years now, and is the basis of our lawsuit, first our lawsuit against AT&T, and now our lawsuit directly against the government. And that is, Mr. Tice made clear, as we've been claiming all along, that the president's description of a narrow, targeted, international-only program is false, and that regardless of who the NSA is choosing to listen to or whose emails they are choosing to read, the fact is they are acquiring the phone calls and emails and other communications of all Americans, including their domestic communications, in what is essentially a dragnet surveillance program, a vacuum cleaner surveillance, where the NSA has its tentacles hooked into key telecommunications switches around the country, and they are sucking up masses of communications in the millions and billions, and then later doing some form of computer analysis on it to try and pick out which needles in that haystack they'd like to subject to further human review.
Kevin, back in July, during the midst of the presidential campaign, many of Barack Obama's supporters were very disappointed with his vote for the telecommunications company immunity for this warrantless wiretap operation. And Obama, basically said it was the best bill possible at the time, and there was a lot of hemming and hawing. But now that he's in power, what is Barack Obama's attitude towards not only the warrantless wiretap operation and the status of that operation now as you know it, but also what's his attitude towards immunity? Is he going to pull the plug on the immunity? Can he? Does he have the power to do that?
He certainly can and does have the power to end this immunity debate on his own and without even going to Congress by instructing his attorney general to simply withdraw the certifications made by the previous attorney general, which are the basis of the dismissal. As you described, Obama was opposed to immunity, and he even voted against it by voting for several amendments to strip it out of the bill it was in, which makes it all the more disappointing that he has not followed through on that opposition to immunity by having the new Attorney General Eric Holder withdraw the certifications in our case and end the immunity fight. It's also disappointing the comments of Eric Holder in his confirmation hearings, where he seemed to indicate that he was very unlikely to change course on the immunity issue, and although it was possible, he couldn't foresee any circumstances where he would withdraw the certifications. It's worth noting that, one, he had a gauntlet of Republicans to get passed for confirmation, but also it's important to note that at that point, and perhaps even now, he was not fully read into or briefed on the program or the legal basis for it or what actually happened.
How can the public play a critical role here in moving our new administration in the White House to actually end warrantless wiretapping and move back from where the Bush administration had been in secret operations to spy on U.S. citizens without any checks or balances?
Well, the Obama administration has said, and I believe it when it says, that it's going to do its best to listen to Americans and provide new outlets for people to speak to the government and make their voices heard. And so I think people out there who care about this need to make their voices heard and make clear to Obama that we trusted him when he said these things about the need for less secrecy on the campaign trail. We believed him when he said these things about the president's surveillance program being unconstitutional and illegal and wrong. And we believed these things when he said there was a real change coming. And I think we need to make clear to him that the American people expect that real change and expect that the Obama administration is not going to continue with a dragnet vacuum cleaner surveillance program that sucks in the communications of millions of ordinary Americans and violates our statutory and constitutional rights.
That was Kevin Bankston, senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. EFF currently has lawsuits against AT&T, the government, and is challenging the constitutionality of the law granting telecom immunity. Contact the foundation by calling area code 415-436-9333 or visit their website at EFF.org. The media frenzy surrounding the published photos revealing that Olympic swimming champion Michael Phelps smoked marijuana during a party points to the hypocrisy surrounding the drug, which is the third most popular recreational drug in America, behind only alcohol and tobacco. In reaction to his admission of marijuana use, Phelps was suspended for 3 months from the U.S. swim team, and cereal company Kellogg's announced it will not renew its product endorsement contract with the swimmer. According to government surveys, some 20 million Americans have smoked marijuana in the past year, and more than 11 million do so regularly, despite harsh laws against its use. But marijuana is considered far less dangerous than alcohol or tobacco. According to the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, about 50,000 people die each year from alcohol poisoning and more than 400,000 from tobacco use. By comparison, marijuana is non-toxic and cannot cause death by overdose. In the past decade, 6.5 million Americans have been arrested on marijuana charges, and tens of thousands are in prison, according to the Drug Policy Alliance. On February 4th, a conference on reforming drug policy was held at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain, Connecticut. One of the speakers was Jack Cole, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, a group founded by retired police officers, judges, and prosecutors, which works to legalize and regulate currently illegal drugs. Cole describes the successful effort last year to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana in Massachusetts.
What I'm going to talk to you mainly about this afternoon is an initiative that we put through in Massachusetts last November 4th that decriminalized 1 ounce or less of marijuana. It took it out of the criminal sanctions entirely, and it made it a civil fine of $100. That means nobody has to hire an attorney to fight this thing. It means in Massachusetts, nobody goes on what we have up there, the pretty despicable law thing called CORI, which stands for Criminal Offense Registration Information. Anybody that gets arrested for a drug violation in Massachusetts goes on this CORI. And when you're on it, you can't get off of it. You're on it for life. And you're on it even if you're later found not guilty. And the CORI is available to any licensing organization, any landlord, and any employer that wants to look at CORI. So what it means is that young people in Massachusetts, 7,500 of them per year, who were being arrested for less than an ounce of marijuana in Massachusetts, were stuck with this lifelong stigma that made it very hard for them to rent, get housing, hard for them to get a job. We've made it practically impossible for them to go to college because we've passed other laws that say if you've been caught with so much as one marijuana cigarette, you can no longer get a grant or loan from the government to go to college. Taking this out of the realm of criminal sanctions means that that doesn't apply to these people. And it allows young people who do something I wouldn't recommend by any means, dipping and dabbing as it's called, in drug use, using marijuana, making a mistake, they're not stuck for life with it. Those of us at LEAP do not believe in decriminalization. We think it's a bad policy, but it's certainly a better policy than we have now. It'll save a lot of people's punishment. The trouble with decriminalization is when you decriminalize, you only decriminalize for the user. Everybody else in that chain is still a criminal. And that means that this artificial value for these drugs, this artificially inflated value, that only exists because of prohibition, still exists. So people are still willing to kill each other, cops and kids, in order to sell these drugs. But if we legalize it, that's all over. But on the way to legalizing it, there's a lot of things we can do on a state and a local level. And you cannot legalize drugs and regulate them on a state and local level. You have to get the federal government or even the international government to do that. So what we did was we came up with this idea in Massachusetts. We rallied law enforcement in the guise of the LEAP to go out and blunt some of these district attorneys and police chiefs' arguments by telling the truth about what was going to happen. And the truth of the matter is that all this thing would do is it would decriminalize 1 ounce of marijuana, and it would help people out. They were making the same arguments, similar arguments to what you heard in this debate about, oh, it's going to be hard for police then to give out these fines. And we were saying, why would it be hard to give out the fine? Every cop carries a ticket book for giving out traffic tickets. You just write in the statute for the marijuana violation and hand them the tickets. It's a very simple thing. But they came up with many, many reasons why they shouldn't do it, and we blunted all those reasons. And what LEAP did when we're trying to blunt these arguments was we talked about giving police officers more time to protect the citizens of Massachusetts from violent criminals. And we posted the stats to show what a dismal thing it is today for solving these crimes, and how in 1963, 7 years before the war on drugs started, we were solving many, many more of them. So the only answer to why we're not solving them today is we're spending so much police staff time and energy chasing around nonviolent drug offenders. And the main group of those folks happens to be marijuana users.
That was Jack Cole, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Contact LEAP by calling area code 781-393-6985. Or visit their website at leap.cc. To register an opinion with Kellogg's about their cancellation of Michael Phelps' endorsement contract, call toll-free at 1-800-962-1413. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.